When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you an interview with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a major legend, Ja Wobble, is here, a.k.a. John Wardle, is a legendary bass player of Pill, producer, incredible songwriter in his own right, a very, very cool person. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, who is the show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram, at LeftForDamien. There is a YouTube page, a TikTok page, and all sorts of things done for this podcast. You can find those on all those platforms, at turnedoutapunk. There is also a way to support the show, and that is by telling all your friends about this podcast, letting them all know that you enjoy this podcast that we do each and every week here on the show. You can also support this podcast by checking out my band. I play in a band. We're called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have we're on tour right now. That's why my voice is strained, so you can hear that live. If that is appealing to you at all, but come on out. We're going to be playing, actually by the time you hear this, I think we're done. I think we're on our way home. So sorry if you missed out, but I'll see you next time. We've got a lot of other dates coming up, including stuff in the UK in the fall. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to the show. Ja Wobble is here. John Wardle, who was given the nickname Ja Wobble when Sid Vicious, a.k.a. John Simon Ritchie, could not pronounce his name. Ja Wobble is, of course, part of the infamous Four Johns, which was John Lydon, the previous mentioned John Simon Ritchie, Ja Wobble, and John Gray. John Gray, you don't really hear too much about, but we talk about this in the episode, so I don't want to repeat myself, but this is just to set up the fact that outside of music, you already have a legendary pedigree with Ja Wobble even before he starts playing music. And then there's all this amazing stuff that he has done in music. Talk about someone who has had an incredible career, worked with all sorts of different artists and inspired all sorts of different artists. Someone I'm a huge, huge fan of, and someone that I've always wanted to have a sit-down conversation with. So I'm very grateful for this happening. Shout out to Mackie from Blitz for helping set this thing up. And shout out to Ja Wobble for being awesome. He is just wrapping up a American tour right now. In fact, there might be one or two more dates, but you can find out more information at jawobble.com. But there will be lots more dates for Ja Wobble as well in the fall around the UK. So hopefully you get a chance to check out the legend in person and see it live. Also, quick little footnotes here. Actually, Honeybane is not Pete Fender's sister. It is Jem Stone, and V Subversa from the Poison Girls is their mother. That'll make sense when you get to that part in the show. I don't know why I thought Honeybane. Anyway. Oh, also, check out Jawobble's documentary, or John's documentary that he did on Sid Vicious. You can hear it on YouTube. It was a BBC documentary, a BBC radio documentary they did. It's one of the most insightful things ever done on the tragedy that is Sid Vicious, and strongly recommend checking that thing out. You can find it on YouTube. I don't think the official one's up, but there's definitely versions of it up on YouTube. And that's it. We talk about it in the episode. You'll hear it there. Oh, and also check out Jawobble's new record, The Bus Routes of South London. You can find that on Bandcamp. A fantastic record. All right, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Jawobble on Turned Out a Punk.
John, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.
Well, as I was just alluding to off air, I thought I had met you years ago, but apparently it was an imposter. So now I get to tell you in person, I am a huge fan of yours, and I am very excited to have this conversation with you today.
I like a good chat, you know, more than anything. So yeah, fire away, mate. Fire away, Damien.
Well, I am, I guess I got to start it off the way they all start off, which will probably be, I'm very excited to actually hear your answer to this. John, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
With punk, basically, it kind of grew up, it developed around me, not exactly me personally, but I'd met John Lydon when I was just 15, I think, and I met him at Kingsway College of Further Education. So it was a place where kids went who had not made it through school and stuff, that kind of thing. And at the same time as we were going there, McLaren had his shop in West London, in Chelsea. Sid, who I also met on that scene, introduced that world to John. The girlfriend I had at the time, she knew that world actually, so she introduced me to it. But John went over there and ended up getting the gig with them. So he disappeared for a while in 75, and then he turned up again at college, and I said, where you been? He said, I'm in a band. And that was the Sex Pistols. And then he invited me to go and see them rehearse. I was very, very surprised that anybody, because nobody was in working class kids, were not in bands at that time, you know. So it was a very surprise when he told me that. And then he said, do you want to come and see us rehearse? And I remember thinking, although I was a real feisty kind of kid, always taking a mickey and having a laugh and winding people up, I remember thinking, this is probably going to be terrible. And I mustn't let him know that I think it's terrible. I must give encouragement that it will be shit. How can it possibly be any good? So when I was very excited to go into a rehearsal room, and there's this scene going on, and went in there, and they were really good. I was absolutely amazed at how good they were. The best one, musician, was Glenn Matlock. So a very melodic bassist. So he was just very musical. You know, he was playing tunes on the bass. I recognised some of the tunes. I was very impressed by that. So I think Matlock really had something about himself, actually. You know, he comes out of the Pistols a little bit unfairly sometimes as a really boring, uptight guy. But he was the first of them to be involved in the shop and everything. And he really must have had something about himself, you know. I think he's somebody who's in a long line of great British rock bassists like Ronnie Lane and McCartney and, you know, these guys who make rock bass more interesting than anyone else can make it, you know, because normally, like the Ramones, the guy just follows do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. They just follow the guitar real cold. They do something else with it, you know?
Yeah, like it's funny because in punk, it's so much of the archetype is set up through the Sex Pistols too, where you have this idea where the bass is almost like the melodic driver of the song in a way that it frees the guitar up to kind of serve as almost like more of percussive guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what, well, I guess it was the punk, just everything was boiled down into a sort of pulse, you know, just chords, you know, it was just very limited to it had that all that kind of dumb element. It was a parody, wasn't it? It was an ironic, let's be dumbed down. We're not really, but let's be dumbed down and make the most basic music. And to, it's like the kind of cultural revolution or something, you know, that to pretend to be anything other than that is a crime, to be an intellectual or to be in any way a hippie. That's a kind of ideological crime. There was a real ideology, this, you know, ever reducing idea of nihilistic sort of revolution, you know, similar in dynamic to the Cultural Revolution or something, you know, whereas if you show any sentiment or bourgeois qualities, you need to be brought to task. It must be resolutely, you know, you didn't write songs about falling in love or the joys of life or anything. You wrote about being alienated and hating people and feeling dysfunctional and inadequate, you know, as punk, you know, in a way. And it's done best when it's tongue-in-cheek, you know.
Yeah, like, I think that's exactly it, where it's stripped down it to the most basic thing. And, like, if you did write about love, you wrote about it from a different way. You wrote about orgasmatic, yeah, maybe that's the, you know, but ever fallen in love, you know, like you wrote about it from, like, you know, like, once again, to continue that sort of like idea of this being sort of the socialist kind of revolution in music, you did have the means of production being seized by the musicians now, like through photocopiers and tape decks, and you had the ability to kind of like recontextualize music in a way that was completely different than it ever had been before, where it wasn't about necessarily making something as a way to get to fame and fortune. It was about producing something because it was art.
That's right. Yeah. That's it. And you know, I think it's funny you say that orgasm I did, that was a Buzzcocks, wasn't it? I think, that, you know, you know, they were very clever, that how Devoto and all that, you know, boredom, you know, was, you know, boredom, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek, very northern, actually, very northern English, you know, it's great.
Mm-hmm. It was, that's the thing, it kicked open this door that so much stuff came in with, and especially as it goes on, and like, I've heard you in other interviews talk about how there's a point where it ends for you, and that's where it becomes kind of a parody of itself, I guess, in a way, where you have these kind of like boot boy punks begin to show up and sort of this transition into a lot of the violence that would kind of assume a certain part of the scene at a certain point.
That's right. It was up to that point, it had been a real outliers kind of outsiders scene. It was safe for girls, gays, anyone. Yeah. You know, I'm not a PC person. I'm not mad on PC terms, but I do like the word inclusive, actually, you know, because I like everyone's included. Come on in, you know. So everybody was included. It was reasonably safe sort of place, you know, for girls and stuff to be. And there was a lot of girls around on the scene, as there always is when scenes are really interesting. There's women about. You know, there's a kind of the sexes are sort of together on it, and you know, and anyone in between, it's just, you know, it's a whole mixture of people. But then you started getting the real boot boy thing by 77. It's all macho, tough guy kind of stuff, you know, very gauche, and you know, a menacing air at some of the gigs. So it become a place where you could feel a bit queasy, a little bit nervous, you know. The punk gig, because you know the boot boys as they tend to do, they get on the bandwagon 2 or 3 years behind everybody else. So by 76, the summer of 76 had come and gone, and by 77 it was becoming a bit of a drag, you know. That humor and that panache we just talked about, that kind of gone, you know, and people were moving on, and of course that kind of become post-punk, really, you mm-hmm. know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's to me when it really gets interesting, is that kind of period where obviously the violence that would assume the scene and ultimately destroy the scene in England in for a large part of the 80s was happening. But at the same time, you've got stuff like the Desert Bicycles, you've got Fuck Off Records, you've got what you guys were doing with Pill. Like, you've got this sort of like explosion that happens where it's not codified by Gary Bushell or by anybody as this one thing. It's just this open door where everyone can come in. And like you're saying, it's Jane County at the same time as it's the Slits, at the same time as it's Cox Bar.
Yeah, that's right. There was some, you know, on the more interesting side of it, it wasn't one dimensional, but it became one dimensional, you know. And then it started to get a little bit more interesting with the Slits, and Cabaret Voltaire were quite an interesting group, you know. And I think musically, people were starting to get away from a two called Fresh, you know, and starting to build compositions other ways, using collage, you know, with Peel. It would start with the bass. And for me, there was a more thing of thinking vertically of the music. It was a big sound, you know, had a totality to it, you know, like standing in front of a Rothko painting or something, you know, rather than listening to lyrics running left to right, so to speak, you know, rather than being linear, you know.
Well, that's the thing that, like you're saying, it made it working class music. It made it anyone could do it. You didn't have to be proficient. You didn't have to have the best gear. If you had the right expression, that's all that mattered. And as terrible as a bass player as I guess Sid Vicious was, he was your friend at the time. I mean, but like, and you saw him firsthand. So according to legend, terrible bass player. That also gave permission in a lot of ways for kids to be terrible at what they do, and brought a lot of cool, interesting art out of that, because once again, people get bogged down in proficiency sometimes, and it gets in the way of doing cool things like a lot of the first wave of punk stuff was.
Yeah, I guess so. Sid was pretty nihilistic, you know. It was pretty dark, but yeah, again, I suppose it was tongue in cheek, you know. Viv Albertine, she won't have that. She still holds a light. Holds a candle for Sid and say, hey, it was brilliant. It was really musical. I never quite saw it, but I believe her. I have no reason to disbelieve her. She saw something maybe I didn't see, you know.
I listened to your documentary years ago, and then I re-listened to it the other day in preparation for today, and it gave a lot of context for who this guy is. And obviously, like, you forgot to talk about this to death, and so I don't want to talk about this and force you to talk about it again, but you can't avoid it in punk, because it does become such an archetype and becomes so romanticized and iconified, and sadly becomes a path that so many people wind up following in different ways, or tragically in different ways. But your documentary gave a lot more context to who this person was and who his mother was, especially with that John Savage clip that you had
in there. Yeah, it was pretty heavy. And he didn't really have a chance. You know, it was very dysfunctional, very dark. And, you know, it was, and he, I think, decided quite early on, you know, this kind of death wish. You know, he wasn't happy, wasn't well adjusted. And that was that. You know, very sad. The thing with his mother being interviewed obviously speaks volumes, you know. So I think he's a pretty kind of unloved guy, you know, and very lost. And you get into that downward spiral. They were just so destructive as a couple. And, of course, it ended up with, you know, with what happened. I think there was just no way out for him, you know. I suppose he must have just thought there was no way of wanting to continue, you know, I suppose, you know. There's a lot of murkiness, as ever, but no one knows exactly what happened. Did he really mean to kill himself? I don't know, you know. It was an overdose, wasn't it? You know, he had an overdose. Was it deliberate? Who knows, you know. But he got locked into that very dark kind of world. And I think when you start to do that, it can be very hard to back out of it, you know. When you go into such a darkness that there's no light there, you need to back out of it as quick as you can, you know.
Yeah, it broke my heart as a parent to kind of hear the way his mom talked about him and just how feral he kind of grew up. And not to excuse what happens, obviously, because there's people around Nancy that I'm sure felt that loss. But at the same time, after listening to that, it's like, this is a, I don't know, just like, it's just such a sad thing. And it also speaks once again, like this play being, punk being a place for people that think differently on all levels and people that have mental health issues, and continues to kind of be a place where people that have mental health issues can go. And sadly, because of that, there's predators, there's drug abuse, there's things that kind of feed off that in a way. And
yeah that's right and strengthens it. I don't just think the punk scene, I mean the punk scene was pretty dark, but the music business generally, you know, I think can kind of do that. You know, these people are not your friends, you know, a lot of people in business, you know, and obviously somebody like Sid, it's impossible, you know, it's become such an icon, it's impossible for them to make and maintain any sort of healthy relationships at all, you know.
I guess, what was it like to kind of watch that happen? And I guess it happened so quickly that it goes from being like this cool band that you're watching rehearse to being this thing that the industry's just fiending over. And I imagine people are asking you to join bands at that point.
Yeah, I didn't really want to get involved with punk. To be honest, I never, as I've said many times, I didn't really like the music. My imagination was already going into other areas, you know, quite abstract in a way, you know, where you start imagining what a band could sound like, you know, with heavy bass and certain kind of drums and, you know, you're thinking of a drum sound that isn't like a rock sound with lots of toms, you know, it's that basic kind of sonic sound that, you know, more that you'd hear in reggae or something, you know, very heavy B lines, toppy kind of guitar, quite an empty sound, but fat bass and more textures than anything. So you start to think that kind of way, listening to a lot of electronic music at the time as well, and that stuff, you know. And so punk never really sort of, you know, attracted me. And so I never wanted to be in bands. And with the Pistols, yeah, they you know, when they start sort of 75, 76, by 78, it was all obviously coming on top. And it was a very ugly scene around them, you know, with McLaren and everything. So it wasn't just a case of some horrible record company and being, you know, the cynical business wanting to exploit them. There was a lot of ugliness in and around the group, obviously, as it has been well documented. So it became, I remember finding that not only punk, but the whole Pistols thing wasn't fun anymore. So you didn't particularly want to see them play or hear about them. It was all, Sid had joined, you knew that was going to be trouble. So it wasn't something that was interesting in any way, really, you know.
Was that before or after sort of that Bromley contingent begins to kind of coalesce around the band?
I think they were around quite early on. They were okay, they weren't terrible, you know, a bit suburban, I guess. I was out the East End. I was pretty kind of feral, I suppose, in a way. I think they terrified people like that, to be fair. But they were around from very early on, to be fair. They were there. There was a lot of posing going on, you know, and all that. And they weren't all bad people by any means. But what you didn't have was any sort of leadership. You didn't have any benevolent big brothers or big sisters. Back to the Cultural Revolution thing, to be a big brother or a big sister would have been sentimental in some way, bourgeois. You know, fuck that. You were better off to be schneidy and exploit someone, you know, weaker than you or something. It was very feral, very unhealthy. In some respects, similar to what I saw of the hippie scene, the butt end of the hippie scene, all peace and love, but it wasn't really. It was about selling people dodgy dope or something, or getting, you know, hustling in some way. Do you know what I mean? You know, and so it wasn't, you know, those squats, all the punks, they generally weren't full of really nice, you know, people being nice to one another, you know, and there was nobody wanted to be some sort of big brother or be benevolent or something. You know, it was trendy to be malignant and not nice, basically. You know,
it's interesting because it does transition at a certain point to kind of the opposite. A lot of, not to say that it's always perfect and that there's still not nastiness in it, but like at a certain point, it becomes more about sort of the idea of doing it just in service of this thing called punk. And once again, there's predators that preyed off that, but the idea of like doing charitable works in the name of punk, not in the name of religion, or, you know, like all these sort of political things that were tied into it. But like, it's interesting that it involves out of such nihilism. And you see that also in Los Angeles, like that early Los Angeles punk scene is also famously, I guess, nihilistic for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. Well, even now you see it with this Rebellion Festival people. People like Anthony, you know, who set this up. You know, and my good friend Anthony Walsh, he's got a punk band, and they're great. I went and did a thing for the French band with a Canadian singer. Do you know the thing? I played a track.
Oh, I wonder. I got to check this out. I'll fix it in the intro.
Yes, yeah, so I'm on their album. And he said, would you play a track? I said, yeah, sure, you know. And so with some of the punk, me and Bill talked about, me and Bill Laswell talked about some of the punk people. They're just kind of freaky in a good way. They're very direct. They do what they do. They like to kind of get all that anger and all the energy out still somehow. It's fun. And good luck to them, you know? And actually, sometimes they play really, they do that Too Cool thing, the basic thing, but they do it really cleanly. There's a real purity is the word to what they do. Purity of intent. And that's good, you know.
Yeah, like that's when it continues to be a place that it doesn't matter how virtuosic you are, how up to date you are with the latest trends, and even how you dress, like as much as people talk about it as a fashion thing, like I think that was a lot open to interpretation. And because of that, it continues to be a place where cool people come out of it, or interesting people.
Really was why punk come up, because we were kind of anarchistic. We were into sort of expressing ourselves. And so that's what this scene grew up around, these bright working class kids in North and East London, you know, that's kind of because of that. There's a spontaneity there, a thing where you don't really care about the straight world, the bourgeois world. You're going to do your own thing. So it's quite individual. And I still live, you know, very much that way, you know. And some of those punk people I've met along the way who still keep to that ideal are very decent. They're very sound ideologically, you know. They don't blindly follow any ideology, you know. There's a real sense of, and some kind of self-discipline there, you know, and self-reliance. So, you know, you'd see they'd have a squat, but it's clean. Everything's well regulated. Do you know what I mean? Some of those kind of punky communes. I've come across a lot of that over the years, obviously, when you're traveling. A lot of venues are run with that ethos, you know.
Yeah, because it's the idea that this isn't necessarily a stepping stone to something bigger that you just move on from. And that's why I think people carry it with them their whole life. Like you talk about going to Rebellion Festival. The times that I've played that festival, looking out there at that crowd and being like, God, there's like 70-year-old people, but there's also 16 and 15-year-old people that are starting bands that are here and that are going to wind up maybe not doing this kind of music, but doing something else and continuing this sort of. Like you're saying, prior to that, not that music is always been the realm of the wealthy or anything like that, but like, it had become like Prague, you know, you needed the right gear. You needed to have the right keyboards, and punk was different. Punk was Devo. Punk was, once again, like the Slits, because I think they're such an interesting band, but punk was also like DOA in Canada, who weirdly had a connection to Jim Walker from Pill. When Joey Keithley's, when Joey was on the podcast, he talked about his friend Jim, who moved to England and joined Pill.
Yeah, old Jim was my good friend, you know. Yeah, it's good in life to have a directness, not to let things get too complicated, too involved, and to also to try to get out the thing of waiting for something to happen, waiting for the big break, waiting for the big chance, and just being right here and now, you know, and being real, whatever that is.
So according to legend, it's John walking down the street with the I Hate Pink Floyd shirt on and Malcolm seeing it. But I heard you talk about maybe Sid singing at one point for the Sex Pistols too in an interview. Did I mishear that?
Yeah,
or is that...
That's what I thought, yeah. I think if you, a few of the books, people like John Savage sort of knew what was going on. Paul Gorman wrote a good book on McLaren. It's worth, yeah, that's really worth a read. I mean, I learned a few things myself from that. You know, I thought I knew all the story and I didn't. And as I understand it, Sid was the one they had their eye on. And I think that Vivian Westwood had recommended Sid to McLaren. And Sid's real name was John at that time. But when it was Johnny Lydon, I think she might have said, or there was talk, oh, no, you got the wrong John, you know. But John, as I recall, to be fair, had a charisma, you know, he did, you know, probably a bit more than Sid had at that time. Sid was a fun guy, but John was something people would be kind of a little bit of an oddball guy, you know, and a kind of guy that people would kind of check out and kind of look a bit askance at, you know. And he was a little bit, you know, he was older than me, so, you know, that counts for a lot at that age, you know, when you're 2 or 3 years older. So he had that going for him. But, he was quite charismatic. So it's not – I remember people telling me the story about Sid was the one they were going for, and I could believe it, you know. But I think John had something about him, you know, that he'd be a guy you'd want to be the singer, you know.
Yeah, I think it would have been a very – well, I don't think it would have turned out the way it did. And it's...
Oh, no way. Well, you know, you've got to have something about you. You've got to have some sort of this kind of nihilistic sort of, you know, which, I mean, most performers have got something of the nihilist about them, to have that self-confidence, that ability to go and do it, go and perform. You know, we've all got that self-centered quality to an extent, I suppose, you know. But I couldn't imagine anybody else sort of staring down volatile kind of crowds, you know, and that's what Johnny Rotten did at that. Do you know what I mean? You know, that psychotic stare, you know, with everybody. And you know, it takes something to do that. You know, those lead singers, I've often got that about them. They've got the ability to do that, where probably most normal people would be terrified. And I don't think Sid could have handled a crowd like that. I mean, it's just my personal view, you know. Mm-hmm. You know,
I've always felt that, and I say this on the show all the time, that being a lead singer is that there's a perfect combination that of mental imbalance that makes you the right person for the job, but then once you achieve that, the exact worst person to be in that position.
I'm not going to argue with you at all.
Nor know. Would my band.
No, I would not argue with you for a second.
Yeah, not for a second.
And I better stay quiet at this point, because there's a few singers I could start talking about.
And it's because it's this like desperate, empty void that you're trying to fill with people's adulation, but then also a deep anxiety that really makes you fear being up there in that position, that, like you're saying, it makes you able to like stare down a crowd as opposed to just throwing fists, which I'm sure Sid probably would have wound up doing.
Well, Sid would have just lost it and it'd been a riot, you know, as there was in Texas, I think, with the Pistols, you know. But yeah, I think the singers are closer to actors, you know. So, you know, they're great. They're sort of seducers. So they have to seduce as well, you know. They have to seduce the crowd. They have to seduce the interviewers, you know. They've got that kind of going on as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a... But then there's also like actors in the way that it's like, well, what am I? at the end of the day. I'm just like a vessel for this music that I'm not writing everything. Like, unless you're a singer-songwriter out there by yourself, like, you're really just the face of everyone else's work. So you're
Well,
never.
I'll tell you a story. It was a guy did some spoken word for me many, many years ago, and I got him to come and do some spoken word, and it didn't work. He's an actor, really, and it didn't really work as well as I thought it would, and it just really didn't work. And I said to him that I just don't think it's working, which takes a lot for me to say that. I don't think this is working. I'd like to leave it. And I told him on the phone, and he was out of town, and he started to cry, literally, and to cajole me and to beg and to plead. And I felt very uncomfortable. So I relented and said, okay, we'll make it work. You just go again, we'll have another rehearsal, and you just do these two pieces. So we did them, and it kind of went okay. It wasn't great, but it was okay. And I said to him at the end of the night, you did well. Well done. It was a good performance. And he said, yes, but it wasn't as good as my performance on the telephone, was it?
See, a lead singer would be crying real tears on the telephone to you and then show up and give the performance of their lifetime.
So this guy just I felt absolutely silly and naive and just, I just felt ashamed of myself for falling for it,
Those Hollywood types.
But it speaks volumes, right?
Absolutely. Well, I guess going back, like, before all this stuff happens, you were into reggae and ska and bluebeat stuff before everything like this explodes, right? Originally, that's your first music?
Yeah, it was my taste. I mean, it wasn't everyone makes it a bit of a big. Can I have a water, darling? Please,
No.
first thing. My wife's just come in and has refused to get me water. And
No.
I'm doing it. And but she will relent. She will get me the water because she's a good person. Not a bad.
Okay.
So she will. But no, it was everyone makes a big deal out of liking Bluebeat, but it was the popular urban music of that time. It was actually the music that was in the charts. It should have probably been even higher in the charts, but the way the chart return system worked supposedly was very much against reggae and ska and they didn't get the chart positions they should have done. But that was the stuff that hurt Desmond Dekker, the Israelites, all the Trojan Tighten Up series, because it came out of the skinhead movement, which of course was a precursor to punk. All these, skinheads. You had the Teddy Boys, the mods, rockers, but the rockers were a bit punky, I suppose, in a way. But you had the mods, which turned into the skinheads, and so thanks, darling, turned into the suedeheads, and then that eventually sort of become punk somehow. Punk was more a continuation. It's very British working class youth movements. I've got my water, by the way.
I think it's real interesting because around the world, kind of in the year 1974 into 1975, you have all these movements begin to kind of pop up, or all these scenes, maybe not even movements at this point, but like in Cleveland, Ohio, you have the stuff that wind up being Peru Boo and the Dead Boys and everything that kind of comes out of that whole world, and in Devo, and then in even in Hamilton, we've got a bunch of stuff bubbling up here in Canada around that time period. But then in LA, you've got the Nerves and Bomp Records. And in the UK, you've got a bunch of stuff too around that point kind of happening. Dr. Feelgood or Pink Fairies or like that kind of like Groundhogs. Even some of that Groundhog stuff sounds vaguely kind of
What
sonically
period
where
are
punk would
you
go.
talking about? 75?
75, 74, like
I
around.
didn't know Devo. I didn't know Devo were going then.
Yeah, they started in 73, I believe. Mark was just on the show, but by 75, 74, you can hear their first recordings, and it's fascinating how. And it once again, it's I've heard you talk about Roxy Music, but I asked Mark, like, where did this whole sound come from? And he's like, there's one sound that Brian Eno makes on this one Roxy Music record on his keyboard, on his synth, I guess. And he's like, I would love to do a whole
What
sound
song
based
was
on it.
that?
I'm trying to remember, and I will send it to you because I have it in the in my notes. I'm just blanking on. I knew you were going to ask that.
I wonder if it's Virginia Plain.
I'm trying to remember now. I wish I had it, like, I don't have my mark notes in front of me. I'll let you know, and I'll fix it in the intro. But, he talked about it on the show that there's this one.
Maybe Streetlight, even.
Maybe it's Streetlight, actually. I think it is Streetlight, maybe. There's a sound that he says on there. And then it was the Kent State Massacre and losing friends. Jerry, I guess, lost friends in the Kent State Massacre. And they were all at Kent State and kind of seeing that and being
now,
like,
what was that? What was that?
The Kent.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
State Massacre is when the U.S., I believe it was the National Guard, went in to Kent State in Kent, Ohio, and opened fire on a bunch of anti-war protesters. And I believe it was 1971, 72,
early. That was all the time of Angela Davis and...
Yes, around that, like, there's a lot of sort of, a lot of interesting upheaval movements around there, like social movements, a lot of sort of, like, bubbling up that just sort of precedes a lot of interesting stuff in music. Obviously punk stuff, but certainly hip-hop and rap music as well, kind of exploding in New York around the same time. Like, it is such a 74, 75, like the early 70s, where the death of the 60s and the death of the promise of the 60s combined with the advent of all these new technologies being in the hands of young people, it's amazing to kind of see what happened. And I think we're seeing it again now with this new technology. Like, I'm not part of it, but I think there's going to be some real interesting stuff and new forms of expression and real authentic expression like punk was.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's interesting talking to Cleveland, because when I first went to America with Peel, I don't think we went to Canada, actually. I think we did. That first trip, except when I first went to North America, I don't think we went to Canada. Anyway, I was very taken with Cleveland and the Midwest, because it was absolute, like, I loved the post-industrial landscape, and there was something really going on at that time. The steaks are lovely, by the way.
Good.
Yeah. You know, so it was, really was, I was very, to make this, so Devo and all that, I was very taken with all that stuff. That kind of interested me, you know. It was such a, there was a real scene going on in the city centres were really run down, and that hadn't come to this country yet. Things were very run down in Britain, but such a sort of, you know, those, you know, Akron and all that, you know, it's huge areas of land, you know, in the way Docklands actually in East London was a bit like that, but it was just all those Midwest cities were just kind of rusting away. It was very interesting. You know, I saw a lot of Buddhist places, I remember, at that time. You know, there was a little mini explosion of Buddhism in the Midwest. I mean, there were lots of Buddhist places and kind of vegetarian places and all that, even then in the 70s, you know, going into the 80s.
That first tour you guys do in America is very storied on this podcast. Michael Olago did your show in New York where there was a huge riot. There's obviously TV appearances that are legendary.
That was after I left the riot. That was when they played behind a glass screen.
Yeah.
I wasn't at that. I did the Palladium show in Gildersleeves in New York.
What was that?
We'd done Palladium, and John and Keith walked off stage after 20 minutes. I thought the crowd were going to lynch us, but me and Martin kept playing, and it all went well. You know, people really liked it. I was furious. when I come off stage, I was effing and blinding. I was really angry. And I just felt he was like going absent without leave from a battle or something. You know, it was horrible. But it was a really schneidy thing to do, you know. But it kind of went well. We did a show at Gildersleeves, and that gig at Gildersleeves was the best gig Early Peel ever did. Gildersleeves gig in New York. And it's all up on YouTube.
I've watched so much of the YouTube videos over the years. There's like so many legendary ones. Obviously, like the Dick Clark appearance is a very famous one, and there's like the Tom Snyder appearance. But like all these performances as well, where there's just like, it's such an interesting band, and it must have been such a weird band to play in, where there's so much hype around what came before and them dying at that time, and then what you guys are doing is, in my opinion, ultimately more interesting. The Early Peel stuff, it's awesome and fascinating and cool where it's kind of going, but it must have been like very adverse conditions to try to be creative in.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, the funny thing is, when the first single we did, the eponymously titled Public Image, people were like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, people liked it because it was like a song, you know. And then we quickly kind of nosedive, you know, into doing more and more and really quickly, you know. I suppose in a way we did what you're supposed to do, a band supposed to do with the self-indulgent fifth album. We did it straight away with Metal Box on the second album, you know. But by that point, people really hated it. Yeah, we've got lots of stinking reviews. But I felt pretty resolute. I really believed in what we were doing. And I knew Metal Box was a special record as well. So it didn't really have any, it didn't make me have any doubts or anything at all, you know.
Well, and history's validated you, right? There's so many bands that are inspired by that record, and very early on, like I remember, even before I was really collecting records myself, just being cognizant of that always being a record that was cherished and sought after, and oh, it's impossible to get it out, a lot of them are damaged, like it is an artifact, and because it's an artifact, it is something that I lusted for and took me a long time to acquire.
Yeah, no, it's a special record, and so at the time I just felt this is very, very special. And then I knew I was going to leave Peel not long after it was finished, and indeed I wanted to get the American tour done. I really wanted to come to America and then leave, which I did. I then the money was kept in a lower floor bedroom at the Peel headquarters, and I went and took it. It was kept under a bed. And then it was kept in like a hole in the wall. Sort of, you know, there was a false kind of tile or something. I pulled it out and I took the shoebox full of money with £50 notes in it, which high denomination notes, you know, that was it. I was done, you know. But I then, you know, I just started doing playing music with other people, started my musical adventure properly, and then came back a few years ago to starting to mess around with the Peel stuff. And then this opportunity came with Cleopatra Records to really do a new version of it. So that was fantastic. So we, you know, that really, and I think when they asked me, I think they thought I'd maybe say, how dare you ask me to do this, an iconic record? Or maybe I'd say, well, I'm not sure. I need to think about this. But I just said straight away, yeah, let's do it. You know, because I was already prepared for it. You know, I'd started playing Fender P again. I was already messing with some of the numbers, doing versions of them. So I couldn't wait to get cracking again, you know.
And it's amazing how your relationship changes to songs as time goes on, I found.
Yeah. Well, with Peel, Pop Times was always my favorite, you know, in every way. I love that tune. Careering, probably the second sort of tune, you know, and I've just come to love them. And now I'm singing them live or reciting them, because I should say his words on that are on Metal Box are prose. They're more like Samuel Beckett or something, you know. You know, he never wrote words like that, from before or since, certainly not written anything like it since then. I don't, you know, not that I know of. Those words are fantastic words, you know.
Well, that's why it would never have made sense with one of the other Johns, other than yourself. It probably may have made sense with you, but like in the sense that like if Sid had been there instead, you wouldn't have had those words. And you know, certainly that was clear in Pill when those words were still there. Like there's unbelievable lyrics on those early records.
Yeah, they're really, they're more like Samuel Beckett, possibly Pinter or something. They're great words, you know. There's a real weight to it. It's a very strange record. And a record that came about because, yet again, we're back down to this lack of leadership. There's no big brother sort of figure. There's no tough manager, patriarchal figure or matriarchal figure. There's the record company's run by a big hippie guy, you know, well-educated English, privately educated guy, Richard Branson. He's not going to tell you where to, he's not, sorry, you've got a fire alarm there, don't worry. I better go and she can't read. Can you read?
Yeah,
she?
I can pause it for a sec if you want.
So yeah, there was nobody, there was no, you know, you didn't have any, you have a tough A&R guy saying, I need some signs, this is bullshit, man. This, you know, there's no changes in these fucking numbers, man. This is crazy. Nobody was going to say that. So we were able to just kind of make this mad record, which, to be fair, you know, we were serious about it, you know. And there was some real intent there. So, yeah, it was a fantastic record, you know, and perfect. I came to realise perfect time for me to do it and go, actually, artistically, was superb, you know. Especially now, coming back and doing the record live again, performing it, you know, my version of it. It's like, yeah, it's actually fantastic to have left it all the way back then and to make this new version of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's, I guess, going back to the start of Pill, it's when Mark was on from Devo. He told this story about being flown out to Jamaica by Richard Branson and being brought into a room with Richard Branson and a bunch of sort of South African investors. And
The South Africans might have been his cousin, Simon Draper.
Oh, maybe.
I think so. I think he was a South African guy. I don't know workings of the finances, obviously, you know, how people work with investors. But I know there was a guy called Simon Draper, who I believe was Richard Branson's cousin. Maybe I'm wrong. And I think they were sort of South African. I think he was South African.
And they got him super stoned. And then they said, we've flown out a bunch of journalists from the Melody Maker, the NME, and I guess maybe probably Sounds. And they are on the beach right now waiting. John Lydon's here, and we're going to announce John Lydon and Devo are joining together, and John's going to be the new singer of Devo.
Really? I didn't. It's for real. Wait a minute. It feels like a weird dream. Yes. I had a dream in the podcast, and a guy told me John Lydon was going to be in Devo. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And he said they were so stoned, they're just like, they started laughing uncontrollably because Mark was like, I couldn't believe the size of his teeth. And he's like, I started laughing. And then I was like, no, that won't work. But he's like, you know, John should form a band that's like really corporate now because he had done an anarchy thing. So why not do a corporate band instead? And he's like, I always wondered if that was an influence on Pill. But he was like, yeah, the plan was for John to join Devo.
Wow, that's interesting. Oh, that's what this whole corporate prestige thing came in. You know, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Not only with the name, but with all the artwork and everything, you know. So yeah, it was all, yeah, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. So that was before he came back from Jamaica and hired the likes of me and Levine, right? Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it was just before, right? Like, and then you guys come back, and I think the amazing thing is that you guys come back, and obviously the two of you joining this band combined with his lyrics and his unique approach to vocaling everything, singing everything, vocalizing everything, it just becomes such an important step in where this whole music scene goes. And the idea of like rejecting fame to do something creatively more fulfilling becomes something that I think a lot of people follow in that footsteps.
Well, I think that my advice to people is it was always been follow your dream. And now that's more than ever. That's my advice, because there isn't any music business anymore. You may as well follow your dream. You know, there's no point to try and play the game. There's nothing to be gained anymore, because there's no, you know, this streaming bullshit. You're never going to make any money out of it. You know, you may as well just do be home for a sheep as a lamb and just be honest to yourself. And my whole career, that's one thing, is that, oh, fuck this. I'm going to do what I want to do, you know, for better or worse. And you stick with it and you plow your own furrow. And of course, you end up with a unique sound somehow, you know. And you have some kind of authenticity and you're true to yourself. So it basically means, you know, the rare times I shave, as you can see, not bad as you, but I hardly shave. And you look yourself in the mirror and just think, well, you've been an asshole in many, many respects of me, that is. But, you know, you have kind of stayed true to yourself, to be fair. So, you know, that's what Absolutely. You have to do. And that record is a very, obviously, Metal Box, there's no, oh, we need a single. There's none of that, you know.
Well, and then it's amazing because, you know, Lydon quits the Sex Pistols, kind of subverts the Sex Pistols by doing Pill. And then you subvert Pill by doing Human Condition, where you wind up doing something kind of, I don't want to say cooler, but something more interesting or more for, like, I obviously love Pill, not undercutting yeah. Pill, but like at the same time, I think the Human Condition stuff is fascinating to me, and the stuff you do otherwise afterwards too. But it's like, you know, you were like being more true to yourself. Like you rejected Pill as being something that wasn't for you.
How it become? You know, it kind of become, it's a great record, Metal Box, but it become bullshit. You know, it become for me, it's a bullshit scene. The business was bad. It was an ugly scene. So time to go. And Human Condition was really, you know, Jim was a great drummer, and it was very honest. So we'd go on stage, make it up on the night, and there were times we left stage, we'd just leave the stage 20 minutes in to talk firmly with each other. This just is real. We have to get real. It's get back out there. And the audiences love that, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like there is, and you're just doing tapes, right? Like there's only the cassettes for Human Condition?
That's right. Yeah, Jim, I think Peel really disappointed him. So Jim just gave it up, you know. He just stopped. I think he never got over the disappointment of Peel, and he couldn't take drumming seriously or that, you know. And so we just did two tapes. Loads of people wanted to release them over the years, and I always, out of respect, asked Jim, and he just actually goes, whenever I ask him, he just laughs. And I go, no, seriously, you know. And Animal would love them to come out. He's a good guy, he's still a good friend of mine. The last time I heard from Jim was the night Trump won the election, and I got a gloating text from Jim that he'd obviously sent to everybody, and it would have enraged a lot of the music business lobbies, you know, just to upset everybody. I knew his game, you know. So, yeah, that was the last time I heard from him, you know.
Yeah.
He was a great drummer, but he stopped and he went off to make films. I think he made a vampire film eventually, you know. And that was, yeah, that was a lot I heard sporadically. The last, I heard some stuff a few years ago, you know, like a couple of years ago, somebody was mentioning, but I've not seen, I'd love to see him. I always got on with him, you know.
And Animal was in the Fatal Microbes before or after?
That's right. He was, wasn't he? I think before. And was that girl? What was the runaway girl?
It was Honeybane was in the group.
Honeybane. He was in Honeybane's band.
Also, she had, I guess, a Pops hit in the early 80s, yeah, too. Yeah. But
he was in, I'm sure he played with Honeybane. And we follow each other on Twitter, me and Honeybane. She was, I think, like a runaway girl sort of thing, you know, from what I remember back then. And yeah, she was in NME and stuff, and so he played with her, and he was a guy just in a local neighborhood to where I grew up in Stepney in East London. So I was in the big pub all the young people used to go to, I kind of knew, I'd met his brother. I knew his brother was a good footballer. And they all were talking about this young, hot, you know, guitarist who's really, really good. And, you know, and yeah, it was great. He was only 17 or something, 18 when I met him, maybe 17, I think, and really got on with him. Dave is, you know, and he's a great guy. And he, towards the end of, so Human Condition, I started Invaders of the Heart doing kind of more world music stuff. And he really liked it, but then he wanted to do something a bit more rock, and he was offered a gig with Nina Hagen. And I'm like, man, perfect for you. This is great news. We have to celebrate. And he had a funny attitude, and I thought something's not right. And he said to me, I'm not going to do it. And I was really angry with him. As Yanks, I was really pissed with him. You know, I was really annoyed and thought it was a cop-out. And I wasn't forgiving him for a while, but he's turned out okay. He's a very happy guy. He just didn't want to trade. He said he'd missed the pub and all that, so he just didn't bother with it, you know.
I don't know if he plays on the Fatal Microbe stuff, but they're fantastic. I love those records. And Pete Fender, who was Honeybane's brother, I believe. Their mom, I think, was in the Poison Girls.
Okay.
So they had like some sort of early sort of punk lineage thing with them. But yeah, like very, like really cool stuff, that Human Condition, Dave. Luckily, it's on YouTube for...
Yeah, well, I really want to get it re-released, actually. So I'm going to have to have a chat with a couple of people. It's about time we moved on that, you know?
How did you meet Winston Tong from Tuxedo Moon?
Wow, gosh. Wow, I haven't thought of Winston for years. But how did I meet him? I think it was through Nicky Mono, the Belgian girl singer. Was it Nicky Mono? She's really nice and was doing well for a while. And she, I think it must even, I think through her, through Play It Again, Sam, in Belgium. And I ended up going to play with him. What was it? Something China. What was it called, that record?
Theoretically Chinese was the...
Theoretically Chinese. That's it. That's the record, yeah.
And then you did a 12-inch with him too, which is, I guess, Theoretical China was the 12-inch.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the distinct, yeah, but they're fantastic records.
Yeah, I haven't heard that for ages. No one's even mentioned Winston Tong to me for a long time.
Well, another record that I have sought for years, and as someone from Toronto, you'd think I would be able to find a copy that you did, was the Rent Boys Inc. Flexi.
That they recorded with. That was, they're Canadian, right?
From Toronto, yes.
Yeah, and they were living, and they had a Scottish singer though for a while, I think, Jock.
Maybe at that point, yeah. And there's so much people from here that like have connection to England or Scotland, right, in Canada, so there might be some sort of thing like that too. But yeah, they were living in London at the time, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Guy. Oh, Werner. Something Werner.
Yeah.
And he's a Toronto guy as well. And Jim knew them all.
It's a fantastic band, like a really important band from here. And a band that links kind of the artier new wave scene to kind of like the more hardcore punk scene. Like they run a lot of tape compilations with some of like the more hardcore bands in Toronto that I feel like a direct lineage with as well. So, you know, once again, it's this network that connects us all weirdly in punk.
Simon Werner.
Simon Werner. That's it. Yeah. Very good memory. Holy.
Well, I haven't actually, but I don't know why I remember that. They were good guys. Yeah. They were okay. Yeah,
they did another 7-inch and a 12-inch, but that Flexi never shows up here. And as you can tell, I have a record buying problem, and that is one that's eluded me for years because, I guess it's a Flexi, right? And everyone destroyed the Flexis.
Did I produce that?
You did. It's an early production for you. Well, other than the Pill stuff, obviously.
I'm trying to think, did I do it at Alaska? Where did I do it? I did it a little. To maybe a little studio in East London, which I've never used before or since.
I'm pretty sure it was Alaska, actually, because I think that's on the Discogs entry where I've lusted after it.
Yeah.
It came with a magazine here. when they released it. There was
That's right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So I at that point it's interesting
And
because
Nick Smash. There was a guy, Nick. Was there Nick?
yeah, Nick Smash, who did Smash Tapes here and Smash Fanzine, which is a unbelievably important tape compilation series and fanzine that was
Yeah.
done in the early 80s here that sort of yeah, covered the whole breadth of
I
underground
mean,
music.
I think we follow each other on Twitter, you know? He's around still. Yeah.
I gotta look him up then. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's wild, the connections. Also, I guess it's after this, but like there's that Mr. X record that you did as the B-side to the Jaw Wobble 12-inch. Or maybe it's just before this, actually.
What's it called?
Mr. X?
Oh yeah, that's Angus McKinnon, the ex-NME writer.
Oh, that was who actually performed on it? It's
Yeah.
interesting because that's 1980, and it does sound very much like sort of the hip hop production that's coming out of New York around that time. And
Right. Yeah, it did. Yeah. That kind of really pared down sound, and you know, and he's doing a at that time. On the BBC, you'd get these air show commentaries. So you'd have these, and that's it's a parody of that, these air shows where, Lancasters would fly B-50 through the flight by. And now, catching Jermaine Phillips in a Lancaster bomber, so it was kind of a parody. I don't think you'd get that now. But at that time you still got it, and it was a kind of parody of that,
it's funny too because it does have that very much like sample record feel to it because of that like found audio.
Well, we were using loops, so even with Blueberry Hill and with the suit, we literally made a loop, but they were literal analog loops. You hold a pencil, make a tape loop, and you'd get this kind of sample kind of sound, and which fly stuff in from the radio. So you were working with samples, but they were kind of analog, really,
That's awesome.
And
Yeah.
loops, they were literal physical loops,
A lot of that production from that time period, especially with the analog stuff, is kind of a lost art form. And as you know better than I even, that it doesn't sound the same in the digital space. Like you can't really replicate analog in any sort of direct way.
It's more alchemic, the analog stuff,
So going to production, like eventually you wind up producing Eno, Brian Eno. What was that like to go from like, because you're a fan of Roxy Music, I've heard you talk about before, to being, in that position with someone who's so well
But he
known
turned
for
up, we
producing.
did a gig somewhere like the Astoria. He turned up and said, "Oh, Brian Eno's here." And I'm like, yeah, And then no, Brian Eno wants to see you. And I'm like, yeah, fuck off. And they're like, no, I'm serious, Brian Eno. It's like, fuck off. And then Brian Eno walks in. And it's like, oh, what, Brian Eno is here. So he says he wants me to produce a record, some recordings he's got. It didn't quite make sense. And so it just turned out that he had these recordings he'd done with Brian Jarman, I think for Jubilee, these little snippets of music, and he wanted me to make something for them. It irritated me because it's like, fuck, why don't we just make a fucking record together? You can make those sounds that Devo fell in love with, and I'll play the bass,
Yeah.
and we'll have faith in what we do. But no, Brivino, you're always going to have to jump through a hoop or two. So there's this. Given these tiny little snippets of music, I always say to people, it reminds me of those MasterChef shows where they've got two teams and they're given a carrot, an onion, some garlic, and a trout or something, a fish, and they've got to make an incredible dinner from five ingredients, So he gave me this, and maybe it was a similar thinking to focus the mind, but. I think I did a really good job. It was tricky. It wasn't a big budget, so it was maybe the first record I ever made on Audio Logic. We had like a prototype version of Audio Logic, so I made it at home. That was all done at home because we didn't have a huge budget. So it was all done in my little spare kind of bedroom studio. Maybe the first one I ever done in that little spare bedroom. It was the begin. It was just before I got 30 Hertz Rebels together, you know.
You also wind up doing records with Can and the Can affiliated people obviously as well. Like what's it like to go to a place where you wind up working with these people that like I imagine they would have been an influence on you as a younger person.
Oh yeah, when I knew Can, I wasn't mad on all the Can stuff. I liked the groove stuff. I liked Jackie Libazay, thought he was fantastic, you know. He was a master drummer, you know. I met them through Angus, the guy, the NME writer. So he knew them and introduced me to them as soon as I left Peel. And I just got on with them, you know. And it was a sort of musical marriage made in heaven, really. You know, Holger was just streets ahead of everyone else, and you in being an interesting player, using all these dictaphones and analog samples and collage, and you know, was just such an imaginative musician. He'd record these guitars very speed to tape down, so he'd get them in tune, but when you played them back, they sounded like balalaikas or something, you know.
Yeah.
So incredible player, incredible, you know. And Jackie was just a master drummer. The only person I know close to Jackie's my son. My son's as good as Jackie Libazay. And a similar kind of vibe. My son, John, he's drummer. And he's got a Banksy and Key in. I knew he was, obviously he's a drummer and he trained as a drummer and he's played for years with a Stockport percussion ensemble. We played with my father-in-law, making traditional Chinese music, and then somehow I started to listen to his playing. It's like, fuck, geez, it sounds like Jackie. Wow.
That's
You know,
amazing.
he doesn't play really loud, doesn't play with lots of toms, you know, but he's an incredible drummer. You know, I was in the studio with him yesterday, and yeah, it's just a joy to play with him. You really lock in when you play with him, you know.
Yeah, there's something amazing about being able to share that with the kids. Like, my kids have really, they're younger. And at this point, they've really rejected everything I've done musically. But I brought them to a show the other night, and seeing them like enjoy music in the way I enjoy music for the first time was just, oh, that's something really special.
That's right. Yeah, it was something that's gradually grown. I mean, they both do sports. So John does boxing. The other son, Charlie, is a good, very good footballer. And he plays Erhu Chinese violin, a Morin Kur, like a Mongolian instrument, you know. And I just started, as they developed over the years, I'm like, wow, that's like krautrock. And they didn't even, I played a lot of stuff to them, but not so much German stuff. So I had to play them, say, check this out. What you're doing is like krautrock. You know,
That's awesome. So was that something that was on your radar back then, like Kraftwerk now and obviously Can as well?
Kraftwerk I really liked, but back then I got into Neu. I really liked Neu. Well, as I said, I really liked the groove stuff, like Hallelujah with Can. I thought it was incredible, and I was more into Jackie. I was really into Holger's solo album, you know, at movies, and he did an ambient record called Conexus that's really good as well. You know, that's as good as Tangerine Dream or something, you know. So Tangerine Dream and all that, I loved all that stuff, you know, kind of ambient-y sort of stuff. They were on Virgin, so I was able to get the records for free,
Yeah,
you know,
the hookup.
which, yeah.
Well, speaking of geniuses, what was it like working with Ginger Baker?
Well, it's funny, it's a moot point. I met Nicky and really got on with him in New York, and I'd sent a tape to Celluloid, and he'd eventually been got hold of the tape. I don't know if it was Celluloid New York or Paris. I think I'd sent it to Paris actually, and somehow he got it, and we met, and he found out my favorite Miles Davis album was Dark Magus, which is also Bill Laswell's. So we started to really, he's like, I've got to tell Bill this. And so we started to hit it off. I was very aware of Bill Laswell from material, you know, that cassette, like in the 78. So I was aware of him from the beginning. He was aware of me from the beginning. So we made this connection. So I got on and they said, well, we really want you to come and play on this Ginger Baker record, Middle Passage was the record. So they flew me over. Well, don't remember everything, but I remember that. I remember that there was, we flew over a hurricane over the Atlantic, and we couldn't, they couldn't even serve teas, coffees, waters there. They couldn't serve any drinks because the flight was just up and down. But I was at the back of the plane watching it all go up, and I felt very relaxed because you're just doing that for sort of 8 hours. And then the hotel I stayed in, I was shaving in the morning, having my once every 6 month shave, and I looked down at my foot. There was a little mouse on my foot. It was a hotel run by Hindus. It was just this lovely vibe. You remember certain things. Anyway, I didn't meet Ginger at that time because Bill and the others had decided it could possibly be a really bad move if we actually played together in the studio. Thanks, darling. They felt that there could be like a nuclear meltdown situation, and that it could end Western civilization. You know, there'd be some sort. So I didn't meet him for years later, and then it was a nice album to play on. And when I met him, it was in Japan, and it was in a restaurant where they served desserts. So you would go and have your noodles and Japanese food, sushi, whatever, and then ramen, you would then, for someone like me, an ex-drinker, druggy person, you would go to get your sugar hit from this Western restaurant, sort of prestige place in this complex. So I'm in there, he's in there, no one else is in there because no one in their right mind would go into this kind of simulated apple crumble kind of apple pie. So we're in there and I get introduced and he's like, oh, Ginger, yeah. Anyway, it's very friendly. You know, he's a London guy, he's a bit older than me. He's a regular guy. It's all fine. The Japanese people come and take my order. I'm very much an apple pie, apple crumble and custard guy. That's me. You know, he ordered rhubarb, but they called him treacle. This was a big, big issue for Ginger. I've met him and he noticed he had the wrong thing and he went fucking crazy. You know, crazy because he then started shouting and threw the thing. It was horrible. So that was I met Ginger and it ended up with the boss of the resort of coming to apologize to him, and he was shouting and screaming, and so they were crying, the Japanese people, and I just lost my shit in the end, and just like, no, stop it now, stop bowing to him, stop it, you're a fool, you sit down there to it, you know. But we got on, you know, and that was our first meeting. So it was a bizarre meeting with him, you know. And then is there any wonder I saw, I loved it, the documentary on him, where it started with him. Basically, I think he broke the jaw, right, of the director with a mic stand, which is pretty heavy, you know.
Yeah, there's a scary quality to him, where there's a lot of stories with him where, like, how did he make it out of that without going to jail or alive?
Yeah. Well, I always heard stories of just how horrible he was to some of the musicians, but in a way that was funny. That's what I always heard, you know.
I think it's one of those things that as long as you didn't have to live through it, or I guess witness it firsthand as you had to in Japan.
Yeah, and it just sounded quite funny, you know. And a lot of the time with it, you know, with a geezer doing that, you would just stand up to him, right? And mm-hmm. You'd just say, have a fight with him, you know. You know, you'd have a straightener with him. This is what you do, you know. But I guess people wouldn't do that. So, you know, so you then make it worse. You have to stand up to people sometimes. But I thought he was a funny guy. You know, he was a character. He's all good, you know.
I think it happens a lot to people in music where a lot of people need to be stood up to by someone. But because they are such a valuable asset, no one's willing to stand up to them and say...
Happens all the time. Yeah, happens all the time. So, I mean, I thought it was tremendously likable, actually, the documentary. And on that tour in Japan, I spoke to him a couple of times after that, and I really got on with him. He was absolutely fine, you know.
Yeah. It's I guess one of those things too with like different people, like, well, like you said with Viv and Sid Vicious, like if you some people have very different opinions of different people.
That's right. And you can, it's fun, you can meet a person. I've known people, big stars, and people say, oh, she was a terrible person. But for me, they were very nice to me. It's fine. What you're supposed to say, I'm sorry. That's, I was lucky and saw a good side of them,
Celluloid Records is such a fascinating label. Like they did so much interesting stuff and brought so many cool records all over the world. Like as a young person buying records used, it was amazing the stuff I'd find on that label.
Oh, it was, just so, I can't remember half the stuff on it, but I think Mano de Bango, was he on Celluloid? I think Mano de Bango. Yeah,
And then like Stiff Little Fingers, Cabaret Voltaire as
Oh, I
well.
didn't know they were on there. Wow. Okay.
I think early like Rough Trade, because I think Rough Trade had some sort of deal early on with them. So, because I think my pressing actually, when I finally got it, probably because of Quebec, was a celluloid pressing, a Stiff Little Fingers record. So,
Okay, wow, yeah.
and like obviously Snake Finger as well, Tuxedo Moon. Like, there's just like a lot of material, as you mentioned. Like, there's just that's the thing is punk gets codified, and so many people try and claim ownership over it. But if you look at it as being everything that kind of came in with it, there's no way you could pin it down to one sound or one thing.
No, absolutely not. No, it brought a lot of energy and it cleared a lot of stuff out and opened up a lot of stuff,
Well, anytime, John, you want to come back on here and talk about the past, the present, or the future, you are always welcome.
Yeah, good stuff.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.